A Sound Mind by Brother R.G. Sargent. Chapter 11, The Sign of the Son of Man. What will be the sign of the Son of Man in heaven? Will there be some phenomenon visible in both hemispheres at which the tribes of the earth will mourn? Or will there be some striking event in the political heavens as the final warning to the saints that the Lord's coming is immediately at hand? These and similar questions have been endlessly debated. But as so often happens, the asking of the wrong questions inevitably brings the wrong answers. Since the Mount of Olives discourse is based on Old Testament prophecy, the first question should be, what is the source of the Lord's language? To what prophecy is he referring? That he is using the figurative language of prophecy is unmistakable from the context. The sun shall be darkened, and the moon shall not give her light, and the stars shall fall from heaven, and the powers of the heavens shall be shaken. Isaiah had used exactly such words of the destruction of Babylon and the overturning of human pride which it should typify. Ezekiel has so described the eclipsing of the power of Egypt. And in Isaiah 34 verse 4, similar cosmic imagery describes the judgment upon all nations, with Edom as typical of the Gentiles, in the day of the Lord's vengeance, the year of recompenses for the controversy of Zion. In all these cases, the political character of the judgments and consequently the political significance of the figures of speech is beyond doubt. Moreover, Babylon, Egypt and Edom are all typical from different aspects of the power of man in opposition to the purpose of God. It was very fitting that the Lord in his Mount of Olives discourse should apply such figures to the overturning of the world order by divine judgment at the end of the time of the Gentiles. This is the time when the moon shall be confounded and the sun ashamed. For the Lord of hosts shall reign in Mount Zion and in Jerusalem, and before his ancients gloriously. At that time, therefore, will come the fulfilment of Daniel's vision of the Son of Man, who came with the clouds of heaven. And there was given him dominion and glory and a kingdom that all people and nations and languages should serve him. The Lord, brief mention would be enough to link his words with Daniel's vision, and the disciples would have no doubt what he was alluding to when he said, "And then shall appear the Son of Man in heaven, and then shall all the tribes of the earth mourn, and they shall see the Son of Man coming in the clouds of heaven with power and great glory." Placed in this setting, the answer to the problem should be evident. The sign is the Son of Man in heaven. He himself, in his coming, in power is the sign, not some event preceding his return. He is the sign of judgment to the world and of the day of God's kingdom. This is so obvious that it's recognised by various commentators such as H.L. Mansell in the Speaker's Commentary, E.H. Plumpter in Eliot's, and W.C. Allen in the International Critical. Widely as their expositions of it may differ, they all acknowledge as their starting point that Christ is the sign. The Son of Man in Daniel's vision was one embodying a multitude symbolically represented by the clouds. And the interpretation given to the prophet was that the kingdom and dominion should be given to the people of the saints of the Most High. So too, in the Lord's use of the prophecy, the clouds of heaven show that he does not come to the world as an isolated figure, but accompanied by those who share with him in the work of judgment. When the tribes of the earth mourn, it is because Christ and the saints have come to take the rule from their hands and destroy them that destroy the earth. Once the allusion to Daniel's vision is recognised, all this seems self-evident, and attempts to identify a particular sign are beside the point. A difficulty might seem to arise, however, in the next verse. And he shall send forth his angels with the great sound of a trumpet, and they shall gather together his elect from the four winds of heaven. Who are the elect? Two things are needed for a correct answer. One is to examine the use of the word earlier in the chapter, as well as elsewhere in the New Testament. The other, and even more important, is to keep steadily in view the motive which governs the whole course of the Lord's words on the Mount of Olives. The cause of failure to interpret correctly this and other discourses is often found in the failure to see the overriding purpose which gives the discourse unity, and so constantly to view the part in relation to the whole. Here the motive of the disciples was to learn what they might look for as the herald of Christ's coming. But as we study the Lord's words, it's evident that his own purpose was very different. It was to fortify disciples to endure throughout the time of his absence. He that endures to the end, the same shall be saved. With this object, he exhorted them to constancy in service, so that they might at any time be ready for him. With the same object, he warned of special dangers at particular crises in the history of the church. The first test would come in their witness to him in the midst of a hostile nation. But this period would merge into the events leading to and surrounding the fall of Jerusalem, and these would involve still further dangers. It is in describing the judgments to come on city and people that he first uses the term elect, which occurs twice in three verses. And except these days should be shortened, there should no flesh be saved, but for the elect's sake those days shall be shortened. Then if any man shall say unto you, Lo, here is Christ, or there, believe it not, for there shall arise false Christ and false prophets, and shall show great signs and wonders, insomuch that if it were possible they shall deceive the very elect. About the meaning in verse 24 there can be no doubt. The Jews will be liable to be deceived by pseudo-messiahs, and the disciples and believers must be forewarned. Behold, I have told you beforehand. They then are the elect, and it was the special and repeated concern of Jesus to put them on guard against false claims to messiahship. If someone whispered, he is in the wilderness gathering his forces, or he is present in secret in the city, they must not be led astray. And who are the elect in verse 22? It's been suggested that they were Israel after the flesh, the chosen people. But there must be strong reasons if we're to think that they are any different from the elect in verse 24. There seems no good ground for departing from the meaning which is on the surface, that events in the downfall of the nation were controlled for the sake of the church, including those disciples who were caught in or around the beleaguered city. So too the word must be understood in verse 31. To apply this verse to the final gathering of Israel might cut the knot of a difficulty. It is not justified by usage in this discourse or elsewhere in the Gospels. The difficulty remains, therefore, that on a superficial reading, the gathering of the elect would appear to take place after the events described in verses 29 to 30. Yet it is not grammatically necessary to interpret the passage so rigidly, and to do so introduces an incongruity when verses 29 to 30 are understood as based upon Daniel 7. The solution must be found in examining the structure of the discourse by the light of its motive. All the way through, Jesus is concerned with the well-being of his church, and it is with this object in view, not merely to make them wise as to events, that he has told them of the coming destruction of Jerusalem. Deeply as their hearts are in the city of the great king, when its time comes they must leave it, with all that the act implies of severance from the Mosaic order. It is partly an answer to their question as to the sign of his coming, but still more with the same object of ensuring their steadfastness, that he assures them there will be no need to inquire into claims to messiahship. A claim which is subject to investigation is by that fact disproved. For as the lightning cometh out of the east and shineth even unto the west, so shall also the coming of the Son of Man be. For the saints, the effect of this coming will be instantaneous and universal. Moreover, they need not ask how or where they might gather to him, but as certainly as vultures are gathered to a carcass, so they will be gathered to the judgment of the world. True disciples need have no fear that they might be missing. But the metaphor of the vultures and carcass brings the world into the picture and forms the starting point for a description of the effect of his coming on the world at large, which is almost parenthetic. He will come in a time of upheaval in the political heavens of Gentile dominion, and his coming will cause mourning among the tribes of the earth, who have not expected him. Verse 31, he returns to pick up the thread of exhortation and assurance to the disciples. It is at that time, not chronologically following his appearance to the world, but in the epoch which he has been describing, that his elect will be gathered from every quarter. The assurance that angelic agency will collect them from the four winds is directly in line with the warning not to seek him in the wilderness or the city. Verse 31 is the climax to verses 23 to 28, and logically completes this train of thought. With this understanding, verse 30 falls into place as the fulfillment of Daniel's vision, in which the Son of Man comprehends the people of the saints, their numbers being symbolized by the clouds. Before this can be accomplished, they must have been gathered. They must also have been judged. But since Jesus is here speaking of the elect in the truest sense, their judgment is for the moment taken for granted. Later in the discourse, in the comparison with the days of Noah and Lot, and in the parables which follow in Matthew 25, he deals fully with the implications of judgment for the saints. It is illuminating to compare with this the account of the discourse in Luke 21, where the selection of material and the presentation of it are so different from the accounts in Matthew and Mark. Comparison is most easily made to the accounts set out in the parallel columns as they are in the Gospel parables, based on the Revised Standard Version of 1946. Luke's record alone says Jerusalem shall be trodden down of the Gentiles, and indicates the lapse of time until the time for the Gentiles shall be fulfilled. And his narrative then flows on to the description of the end of the Gentile times, which includes the reactions of fear in the earth and turbulence in the sea, as well as the disturbances in the ruining heavenly bodies. These lead on to the description of the coming in power. Whereas in Matthew and Mark the events of the end come in as a kind of parenthesis, momentarily holding up the flow of thought, as the parallels show, Luke has nothing strictly corresponding to Matthew 24 verse 31 and Mark 13 verse 24. In harmony with the greater emphasis here placed on the course of events as an indication to his disciples, Luke verse 28 is an encouragement to them in the time of trouble. When these things begin to come to pass, then look up and lift up your heads, for your redemption draweth nigh. The words can be taken to imply that their redemption is nearer than the manifestation of Christ to the world, as must indeed be the case in the light of the teaching on the subject as a whole. The discourse itself must have been fuller than any of the accounts of it, and Luke's selection keeps more clearly in view the needs of Gentile believers in later times. But a comparison of his record with the others tends to confirm by its very omissions the interpretation here placed on the earlier accounts. One feature all the accounts share is the sign of the reviving fig tree, although even here Luke has characteristic modifications. Fresh in the minds of the disciples was the active parable they'd witnessed when Jesus cursed the barren fig tree and it withered from the roots up. Now they were told that believers would not be without evidence when the long winter of their Lord's absence was passing. Israel's fig tree would put forth new leaves. The whole discourse is the answer to the disciples' question, what shall be the sign of thy coming and of the end of the age? Yet it at once gives and withholds what they are seeking. It gives abundant information of things to happen, yet it leaves them with the exhortation, watch ye therefore, for ye know not what hour your Lord doth come. It reveals many signs, yet it left them as servants, keeping the house in constant readiness for the Master's return at an unknown time. Because of this paradoxical character, down through the centuries, the discourse has served its double aim of at once rousing expectation and counselling continuing endurance. With all the knowledge that unfolding events give its message, stands today. But of that hour and that day knoweth no man, no, not the angels which are in heaven, neither the Son, but the Father. Take ye heed, watch and pray, for ye know not when the time is. To have foretold one particular sign which at a given moment would unmistakably show that he was about to appear would have defeated the very object of the discourse. And to look for such a sign is completely irrelevant. As it is, the discourse stands as a constant exhortation to vigilance and prayer. The prayer is the vigilance of the saints.